Welcome to JourneyWithJesus.net, a weekly webzine for the global church, now with readers in over 180 countries. I'm Daniel B. Clendenin. My essay this week is entitled Tookie Williams and Redemptive Transition, and is based upon the lectionary readings for Sunday, January the 8th, 2006. After 25 years of appeals and delays, on December 13th at 12:01 a.m., the state of California executed Stanley Tookie Williams by lethal injection. He was 51. Williams, who maintained that he was innocent, was convicted in 1979 of murdering four people. For a dozen years, he distinguished himself as a violent inmate on death row at San Quentin State Prison. But then, around 1992, Williams repudiated his life as a gang member. He wrote children's books, gave speeches, and was even the subject of a Hollywood movie starring Jamie Foxx called Redemption, the Stanley Tookie story. Skeptics insist that his conversion was a shameless ploy. Only God knows Williams's heart, or yours or mine for that matter. I pray for his soul, and I pray that Tookie Williams prays for mine. But I was interested to read an interview that he gave to Kat Aaron of KBAI Radio in Pacifica, California, only a few hours before his execution. Listen to what Tookie Williams had to say. I got up this morning, I cleansed myself, I prayed, I exercised, and now I'm talking to you. Or, prior to talking to you, I was talking to my mother. Of course, she is quite encouraging, spiritual, and so am I. In my lack of fear of this barbaric methodology of death, I rely upon faith. It has nothing to do with machismo, with manhood, or with some pseudo-former gang street code. This is pure faith and predicated on my redemption. So therefore, I just stand strong and continue to tell you, your audience, and the world that I am innocent. And yes, I have been a wretched person, but I have redeemed myself. And I say to you and to all those who can listen and will listen, that redemption is tailor-made for the wretched. And that's what I used to be. At this point in the interview, Williams was asked how he would like to be remembered. I have been asked the same query not too long ago, and I said just one word. Just one word can sum it up in a nutshell, and that is redemption. I can say it no better than that. That's what I would like the world to remember me. That's how I would like my legacy to be remembered, as a redemptive transition. Something I believe is not exclusive just for the so-called sanctimonious, the elitists. And it is not predicated on color or race or social stratum or one's religious background. It's accessible for everybody. That's the beauty about it. And whether others choose to believe that I have redeemed myself or not, I worry not, because I know, and God knows, and you can believe that all of the youth that I continue to help, they know too. So with that, I am grateful. So I thank you for the opportunity, and I say to you and to everyone else, God bless. So take care. Whether a saint or a charlatan, Tookie Williams' last words illuminate the heart of the gospel and the scriptures from the lectionary for this week. The Old Testament reading comes from the very first page of the Bible. In this poetic picture of creation, at the end of each day, we read six times the rhythmic refrain of how God saw that it was good. Then, the seventh day culminates with an unequivocal verdict. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Genesis 1, verse 31. But only 5 pages into the story, humanity experienced a catastrophic reversal. We read in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, "The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time." Christians call this part of the story's plot original sin, and although we do not know how, when, or why this tragedy happened, we can say a few things with confidence. G.K. Chesterton once observed that although Christians affirm any number of doctrines that you cannot prove, the idea that people are sinful is the most empirically verifiable of all ideas. If people are inherently and essentially good, then why is our world characterized by such barbaric cruelty, globalized violence, unfettered greed, and exponential inequities between the rich and poor? Clearly, something has gone very badly awry with humanity. The notion of original sin, Chesterton said, explains why, on a beautiful Sunday summer afternoon, two young children would decide to torture a cat. Or, I might add, why a Tookie Williams would blow away 4 people with a shotgun for mere chump change. Experience also demonstrates that people do not always sink to their moral lowest. It would be ridiculous to argue that people are only evil, or even mostly evil. We encounter truth, beauty, and goodness in one another often. Those distinct echoes of that first page in Genesis with its sevenfold refrain. "The sane man," said Chesterton, "knows that he has a touch of the beast, a touch of the devil, a touch of the saint, and a touch of the citizen. Nay, the really sane man knows that he has the touch of the madman." We are then a mixture of both the good we read about on the first page of Genesis and the chilling evil that we encounter 5 pages later. We are not talking here about other people, only about death row inmates, or about your crazy uncle. We are talking about our very own selves. For as Solzhenitsyn once observed, this disconcerting but empirically verifiable mixture of good and evil cuts straight through the center of every human heart. The ultimate battle, compared to which every other struggle is merely superficial, Tookie Williams observed in another interview, is what he called, quote, "the enemy within oneself," end quote. To win that battle signifies life. To lose it dooms us to a downward spiral towards death. In my best moments, I realized that I, too, might have become a Tookie Williams. If I had grown up in a different family, if I inherited an unfortunate roll of the genetic dice, if I suffered the full consequences of every foolish decision I ever made, or if for some inexplicable reason I succumbed to every impulse to greed, lust, anger, or hatred that my brain's neurons fired. Original sin, then, is hardly a cause for finger-pointing. Nor is original sin a cause for pessimism. Contrary to misunderstandings that characterize the Christian affirmation about sin as misanthropic, Chesterton was also right to declare this doctrine not only the most empirically verifiable, but also the most hopeful of ideas. The explanatory power of the doctrine of sin permits us to be ruthlessly realistic about the world in general, and about our personal selves in particular. A sober acknowledgement of my sins is the first step toward liberation from my endless strategies of denial and self-justification, along with my pathological need to fix or control other people. Freedom from delusion, the joy of forgiveness, and tenderness towards others and ourselves all result from the notion of sin. The gospel for this week takes us to the very first page of Mark, where we read about the eccentric John baptizing in the desert region and preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. People flock to the desert, confessing their sins. Remarkably, Jesus included himself in this penitent crowd that John rebuked as a brood of vipers. Jesus, we read, came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Why did Jesus the Greater undergo baptism by John the Lesser? With this symbolic act, Jesus inaugurated his public ministry by identifying with the faults, failures, and moral frailty of broken people. Before too long, the sanctimonious religious crowd derided Jesus as a friend of gluttons and sinners. The repentance that John calls for triggers what Tookie Williams described as a redemption transition. Consisting of more than remorse or regret, genuine repentance gives evidence of a change of heart that leads to a change of actions. By God's grace, we turn around and head in a different direction. As such, repentance requires both singular acts and a lifelong habit or mindset. We confess particular sinful actions and attitudes and remain mindful of our fallen nature. Rather than a misanthropic denunciation, repentance is a lifelong affirmation or declaration because it invites us to make a new start no matter how often or how badly we have failed. Christians thus celebrate a spirituality of imperfection that is rooted in the desert monastics of the 4th century. These colorful oddballs took their inspiration from that first desert baptizer, John. In their own unique way, they had committed themselves to a redemption transition, to human healing, rather than to theological abstractions. And by experience, they discovered the breadth and depth of the battle that rages in the deepest recesses of the human heart. Interestingly, they were not embarrassed by what they discovered, nor did they engage in shame and blame. Rather, they grew comfortable with the theological grammar of Genesis 6, verse 5, and the healing power of heeding John the Baptist's call to lifelong repentance. Refreshingly candid, ruthlessly honest about the interior landscape of the desert in their hearts, unfailingly tender towards other people, and patient toward all, these eccentric ascetics speak an ancient wisdom that commends itself to our modern world. Writing in the 7th century, St. Maximus the Confessor concluded, quote, "The person who has come to know the weakness of human nature has gained experience of divine power. Such a person never belittles anyone. He knows that God is like a good and loving physician who heals with individual treatment each of those who are trying to make progress." And now a few questions for reflection. What was your opinion of Tookie Williams's ostensible conversion? Number two, what do you take from the fact that Jesus was baptized among a group of sinners? Number three, what have been your own experiences of the mixture of good and evil within every single person? And finally, do you find the notion of a spirituality of imperfection helpful or not? My book review this week is of a book called Where God Happens, Discovering Christ in One Another by Rowan Williams, Boston, New Seeds Publications, 2005, 174 pages. The bland title of this book gives no hint of its powerful subject matter or of its important message. Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury and the leader of the worldwide Anglican Church, introduces the Egyptian desert fathers and mothers of the 4th century, and he does so in such a way as to show how and why they remain so relevant for us today. I count this as one of the best books on Christian discipleship or formation that I've read in the past year. If you are unfamiliar with desert monasticism, this book is an excellent place to start. An introduction situates the monastic movement in its day and age, suggests some of its salient characteristics, disabuses us of superficial caricatures, it makes liberal use of primary sayings and stories from the monastics, and best of all, it suggests specific contemporary applications for church life today. Williams is not only a notable scholar, he's an excellent writer with enviable pastoral sensitivities. In 4 chapters, he examines life, death, and neighbors, silence and honey cakes, the idea of fleeing, and then finally, staying. The book concludes with a substantial collection of the sayings of the Desert Fathers organized by theme. For example, hospitality, obedience, modesty, charity, discretion, humility, and so on. An all too brief bibliography suggests further reading. Probably no one who reads this book will become a monk, but that's besides the point. One of the desert mothers, Amma Syncletica, explains, quote, "There are many who live in the mountains and behave as if they were in the towns. You can be solitary in your mind, even when you live in the middle of a crowd. And you can be a solitary and still live in the middle of the crowd of your thoughts," end quote. For the desert monastics of the 4th century, and for us today, the interior geography of your heart is far more important and complex than the exterior coordinates of your address. Whether dealing with the prosaic boredom of everyday life, conformity to culture, our individualist impulses, our rosy romanticism that exudes naivete, flight from responsibility, the terrors of temptation, discouragement and lethargy, or the ego's endless quest for self-justification, these desert saints are competent advisors. Their wisdom comes from hard-fought experience and is not mere arid theory. Contrary to common misperceptions, these faithful guides are people of tenderness, honesty, humor, and humility. We Christians need their wisdom more than ever, and this book by Rowan Williams is a fine place to begin. My film review this week is of the film called Spanglish, 2004. Adam Sandler in a serious role? Yes, after a fashion. As the most famous chef in America, a husband and a father, Sandler plays John Klasky. He's married to Deborah, a suburban housewife who raises the bar for what it means to be a type A control freak. When we meet her mother, Evelyn, we understand why. This Los Angeles family is very wealthy and profoundly dysfunctional. Enter Flor, a Mexican housekeeper who has a teenage daughter, Christina, who is the same age as the Klasky's daughter, Bernice. Since her mom, Flor, does not speak English, Christina narrates the film for us. You can easily imagine the subplots of this blended family, but in the end, Flor is a source of humanity, warmth, and normalcy for everyone. This is a great film which I highly recommend. Spanglish. For poetry this week, we have posted the poem Epiphany Poem by George Mackay Brown, who lived from 1921 to 1996. The Red King came to a great water. He said, "Here the journey ends. No keel or skipper on this shore." The Yellow King halted under a hill. He said, "Turn the camels round. Beyond, ice summits only." The black king knocked on a city gate. He said, "All roads stop here. These are gravestones, no inn." The three kings met under a dry star. There at midnight, the star began its singing. The three kings suffered salt, snow, skulls. They suffered the silence before the first word. Epiphany poem by George MacKay Brown. And finally for this week, I'm pleased to announce that we're beginning monthly music reviews written by David Werther of the University of Wisconsin. David begins this week with a review of My Mother's Hymn Book by Johnny Cash, American Recording Company, 2004. In 1954, a young man whose mother had told him his voice was a gift from God called Sam Phillips of Sun Records. Johnny Cash told Phillips he wanted to record gospel music. That effectively ended the conversation. Phillips said he couldn't sell gospel and wasn't interested. In fact, Phillips was on the cusp of the major cultural revolution that we've come to know as rock and roll. In 1951, he recorded the first rock and roll record, Rocket 88, thanks to the talent of Ike Turner and company, along with a broken amplifier that gave the music a new sound. Then, some months before Cash called in 1954, late one night in the recording studio between sessions, Phillips heard a shy singer open up on a song called That's All Right, Mama. He decided then and there that that was the sound he wanted from Elvis Presley. Despite his initial rejection, Cash later managed to get an audition with Phillips. Phillips liked what he heard, but he still remained adamant and was opposed to Cash recording gospel music, even as the B-side of a record. Instead, Phillips recorded some classic Johnny Cash, including Hey Porter and Folsom Prison Blues with its infamous opening line, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die." Even so, when Cash had the chance, he bolted to Columbia Records to have the opportunity to do gospel music. Cash made some gospel records with Columbia, but his favorite recording, gospel or otherwise, came late in his career, and after his long association with Columbia. In the posthumously released My Mother's Hymn Book, in the liner notes, Cash writes, "You asked me to pick my favorite album I've ever made, and this is it, My Mother's Hymn Book." The music is all from a battered hymnal that Cash inherited from his mother. He cut all 15 songs in a single day. There are no production gimmicks here, just Cash's guitar and voice. The voice Bono has called the most male voice in Christendom. Cash's selections have special significance. "Let the Lower Lights Be Burning" was sung at his father's deathbed. "When the Roll Is Called Up Yonder" was part of his beloved Jack's funeral service. Jack, his brother, was a devout Christian who died from the cuts of a circular saw when he was 14. He had been sawing fence poles to try to bring in some more money for the family. The song "When He Reached Down" was one of his mother's favorites. In the liner notes, Cash calls himself a C-minus Christian who had his wilderness years. "I had to finally accept it, you know, that God thought there was something worth saving." In the songs on My Mother's Hymn Book, we have the privilege of listening to an American master singing about what matters most to him. This CD is a testament of grace and faith, an opportunity to share in some of Cash's deepest joys and sorrows. The C-minus Christian, in my mind, gets an A+ for his recording, My Mother's Hymn Book. Thank you for joining JourneyWithJesus.net, a weekly webzine for the Global Church, for Sunday, January the 8th, 2006. And please join us every Monday for a new essay, book note, film review, poem, And now, on a monthly basis, music reviews by David Werther. I'm Daniel B. Clendenin.